Well, thanks for joining for the final talk in this series on the aftermath of 325. A seventh consequence, and I'm not saying there aren't more, but I've chosen seven, of the council and the subsequent councils is what I'm calling the embrace of coercion. For example, the emperor, Constantine, decreed that those who refused to endorse the Nicene Creed must be exiled. You had to be exiled. Arius, Theonius, and Secundus were exiled to Illyria, in addition to being excommunicated. I mean, exile is a geographic and like a political penalty. You're outside the empire. You no longer enjoy its protections. Being excommunicated means you're out of fellowship. But exile, you know, when I was young, I thought, well, that's not so bad. You know, it's not like going to prison. Wouldn't be that hard. But wait a minute. You'd be separated from people you knew, from your community. You'd be a stranger in a strange land. This could be very painful. It was the punishment that John suffered on the island of Patmos in Revelation 1. He's exiled. In Ephesus and in that part of the province of Asia, he had influence and friends, many Christians, and now he's basically alone. Well, tradition says he had one friend with him, but it's lonely to be on an island and you don't know how long you're going to be there. And it's loneliness. It's a psychological penalty. It's emotional. Well, that was a penalty. In fact, the council said, if you have the writings of Arius, just possess them. There's a death penalty. Constantine made this ruling, and as far as I know, not one of the Christian leaders objected. Not one who was present said, this is wrong. Now, perhaps it's hyperbolic language, kind of like the war reportage in the Old Testament, or like the capital punishment legislation of the Old Testament. What I mean is capital punishments were virtually never carried out, but except for murder, but they showed the fact that there was such a law shows that the sin was very serious. But still, even if they didn't execute Arians at that time, the church would be executing people in the future. Constantine exiled a few bishops, but only after they were condemned by councils. But his son Constantius I did this much more freely, even without conciliary approval. He would just do it on his own. He would say, you're out, you're exiled. And so that started a new trend. In fact, multiple precedents were set here, like state power, relying on the state, bullying, book burning, torture and execution, and I mentioned exile. Very harsh. And yet, increasingly, the immorality of leaders was overlooked. Even emperors who murdered others were still permitted in church. Constantine, by the way, killed his son Crispus in 326. In fact, that year he also executed his second wife, Fausta. Did the church complain about this? Not that I'm aware of. Now, some would say, but Constantine wasn't officially a Christian because he wasn't baptized until he was on his deathbed in 337. That's true because there was a mistaken idea that if you sin after baptism, well, you can't be saved. And so a lot of people were delaying their baptisms. And I can't psychoanalyze the emperor. There were certain things that were probably required in the course of being the emperor that were dirty, that were brutal, that were violent. Are Christians allowed to even participate in this? But here's the kicker. By the 7th century, Constantine's been canonized. Now he's Saint Constantine. Bishops would denounce rulers of states, I mean, if they were heretical. If they were immoral, less likely. Less likely would they say anything about it at all. So it's more important that you're in the right camp, that you believe the right thing. How you live, that aspect of discipline is just ignored. In the East, the entire church had become subservient to the state, and the West wasn't far behind. We see this in our own day. In the evangelical movement, we see a shift towards violence, especially since the 1970s. Not just being pro-war, but being in favor of not disciplining leaders who are abusive or violent, those who are not gentle. And the book that I enjoyed, and you might enjoy too, which explains this very well, is called Jesus and John Wayne by Dumay, Christian Corbett Dumay. Well, what else? Religious freedom. You know, as Tertullian noted, and this is probably around the year 200, maybe just before, he noted that Christians were the first group in the ancient world to introduce the concept of religious freedom. And that's true. So religious freedom is a Christian idea, free to choose without state coercion. Tertullian, who was a brilliant lawyer who became a Christian, and this is in North Africa, said, "Religious faith is an inward disposition of the mind and heart, and for that reason cannot be coerced by external force." He also said, "It's only just and a privilege inherent in human nature that every person should be able to worship according to his own conviction. It's not part of religion to coerce religious practice." Now, if you're running ahead of me a bit, you may be thinking, what about the Middle Ages? In fact, even in parts of the modern age, tremendous coercion. I don't just mean the kind of coercion some people, I was talking with a neighbor the other day, and she said that she gave up because she found Christianity to be oppressive. She was brought up, I don't know if it was a local priest or the bishop, but she quit when she was 17. That was like 65 years ago. But I'm not talking about that kind of oppression. I'm talking about the kind where you're imprisoned, fined, or tortured, or even executed because you don't agree with someone else's conviction. That's profoundly anti-Christian. In fact, there's another, there was a leader named Lactantius. This is 4th century. And he also taught the same as Tertullian. And this fact, this man, in fact, was the tutor of Constantine's sons. Constantine had Lactantius, a Christian leader, tutor his sons. And he was just another proponent of religious freedom. In fact, he said they should be free whether they're pagans or Christians. We shouldn't force them. Now, I don't think Constantine's sons got the message. You know, although the election of church leaders, bishops, episcopal elections were normally peaceful, there were still armed riots that sometimes took place if the wrong guy was elected. And this is another thing that this shocked me when I studied church history in grad school. And for me, it was what was going on in the 400s, but worse would come. But, you know, monks marching through the streets with clubs, you know, going out to beat up those who had a slightly different theology. In fact, we should also consider that Nicaea sets a precedent for the persecution of not just schismatics, you know, heterodox Christians, but also of pagans and Jews. Now, the truth is that at first there was a certain degree of tolerance for Jews and pagans, not so much for heterodox Christians, but in time this all went away, and soon you had to be a Christian, even to be a school teacher. There's a famous historian, a pagan, an outsider, named Ammianus Marcellinus. He lived 330 to 400, and this is a quote I often use when I teach church history, because he's commenting on the state of the church just a few decades after the Council of Nicaea. Listen, "No wild beasts are such enemies to mankind as are most Christians in their deadly hatred of one another." Wow. Well, again, in case you forgot, I would have probably loved the Council of Nicaea. It must have been very exciting. Councils, conferences, if they can accomplish something and hash things out, you know, hammer things out, study the Bible, that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. I probably would have loved to have been invited had I lived back then. And yet, knowing human nature, knowing myself, I'm not sure I would have been the one speaking against the way things went. Probably I would have been like everyone else. Probably. I mean, it's easy to say if we lived back then, we wouldn't have behaved that way. But really? Jesus actually challenges that kind of thinking himself in the end of Matthew 23. Yeah, if we lived in the days of our forefathers, we wouldn't have stoned the prophets. Really? Jesus says. See, some dangerous precedents were set, particularly because of the alliance of church and state. State church, church state, police state. I mean, the church was everything. It was the center of life from henceforth. I mean, the Middle Ages in the Western world. And there were some good things that came out of that. It wasn't all bad. But there are some things that give me pause. And so just to review very quickly, the aftermath of 325, what do I see? Shibboleths and labeling of others, you know, controlling them, dissing them. Artificial unity, the pretense that we're all on the same page, everything's fine, artificial though. Hierarchy and honorifics. Hierarchies, complex hierarchies, really based on the government. I understand that as a pragmatic matter, but the hierarchy, if you want to call it that, in the New Testament is really, really simple. Honorific titles are forbidden. It was funny because when I got my doctor of ministry, I started getting, now the letters I got from the university referred to me as the Reverend Dr. Douglas Jacoby. Okay. Titles. Lack of grace, number four. And perhaps in a way that's at the heart of all of these. Going beyond apostolic teaching, five. Six, selective interpretation and memory. You know, just cherry-picking the bits of history and ignoring other parts that refute our position. And seventh, the embrace of coercion. Now, using force, including the power of the state, the violent power of the state, to cause there to be uniformity. Those are some of the concerns, some of my concerns. And what I'm calling crucial transitions. Okay. Just a few more comments, and I'll let you go. You know, back in the early second century, let's say the year 125, there was little difference between the visible church, the invisible church. What you saw is what you got. There was some politicking, but not a lot. It was not easy to be a Christian. In fact, quite dangerous. Fast forward 200 years. In the aftermath of 325, the difference is enormous. Rome is no longer the Antichrist, as she was considered before. Now Rome is the servant of God, the engine of the kingdom. It was Roman emperors, in fact, who called all seven of the official ecumenical councils. And very soon the church would be thoroughly married to the state. Now, there were many who refused to accept the state church as a true church of Christ. For example, the Church of the East, which in terms of territory was far larger than the Catholic and Orthodox factions combined. You know, the ones who took Christianity to China, Mongolia, and so forth. But it's a fatal cocktail of church and politics. It's not a good combination, and that's proven by subsequent history. Now again, had we lived through this period or attended the council, would we have got it right? Hindsight's a wonderful thing. I'm not sure I would have. And as for Nicene Orthodoxy, even today, many Bible believers misunderstand the council. And they'll teach that what the council rejected was that the Son was subordinate to the Father. Well, that's not what the Bible says. He was subordinate to the Father before the incarnation, during, and after. But that's a different point, isn't it? And last, please read the pre-Nicene literature, the literature of those first three centuries. You won't find any mentions of dioceses and fancy titles and icons and incense, but you will see a lot of good stuff, and you may find inspiration, wisdom, and even fellowship. Well, that's the series, The Aftermath of Nicaea, Seven Crucial Transitions Following 325. God bless you. Hope this will be useful to you for your perspective and faith.